the street and the new agency. That would be my, at this time, would be my input.
It isn't. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it isn't an existing agency. It's going to be done by Department of Labor as part of their function.
So why does it take a bill? Why don't we create the budget? Why don't we come in with a budget and say, need another 40,000 or 140 or whatever it is, fill it in the budget? I don't see why it has to be a new bill, a whole legislative process to accomplish an added task population.
So if you can think about it, you gotta have a bill.
Yeah. I'll tell you frankly, I think the Department of Labor needs this kind of injection into the system. I don't think that the Department of Labor has generated enough information in this area, and I don't know whether they have the capability to generate some of this without legislative input. It's just that I don't think that we would be able to do this. Just basically leaving it to the Department of Labor. I think perhaps I'm showing my little prejudices about their work, but I don't think that they have been developing a kind of labor force that I would be very convinced has been to benefit the state. So I think this is a good deal because it gives them direction as well as gives the legislature some kind of an input. And I just want to say that because I feel that it has merit and it is something we will need to do a little bit more and talking about the Department of Labor in this area because I don't think we are preparing our labor for the blackboarding work that is going on in the state and maybe this will help. I do want to ask a question in terms of the migration for the country. Question there on migration study, specifically on the primary labor force, where still in my review of the migratory nature of the labor force of the primary, the textile industry, we found that many of our labor, the labor comes from Seattle. Even to this day, and I don't know if that, you know, because that's one of the migratory labor that we have in the state. And this summer, we seem to have more and more people come outside. Although I understand the Department of Labor is coordinating the employment of local labor, but I don't think that it is sufficient work. And could you comment on that? What are you going to say about this migratory aspect of the primary
record? Yes, in fact, there's two or three points I'd like to comment on from your comments. One, going back to some earlier statements, prior to 1979, our research unit was 100% federally funded, and so the information systems developed were developed to meet primarily the federal needs. And so that was looking at statewide information, annual averages, things like this, that met the requirements, met the staffing levels they were ready to do. With this bill, we could be in a better position to meet the state needs and to improve farming safety. On the migration, there's more than one component to it. One that's dimensioning is of a seasonal nature. Where people come up to work here for 3 or 4 months, they go back. We've got a small portion here to study the unemployment insurance and unemployment service database. One thing that we want to do now that we have a new benefit system is see whether we can compare between quarters in the data, something that has never been funded to do before, to be able to track which people work in all quarters of the year, and which ones start drawing claims out of state in particular industries and such, to get a better handle on which industries are most heavily affected by people coming in from outside of state and in which occupation. The another portion of the migration is of a longer term nature. rather than someone coming up to work 2 minutes in the cinema, he's going to come up to work on a large construction project just a few or 3 years and then go back down and taking
that large amount of wages with him. For that, we've proposed doing the push-pull type analysis. The seasonal migration would have to do in the study of those existing databases, but it is an important component, as you suggest.
This is the boss,
Mr. Chairman,
you finished that?
Well, I would just like to comment about up to 1979, you say the state Department of Labor hasn't really addressed the in-state issues because you have been too busy doing federal compliance. Is that what you say?
What I said was that we received 100% federal funding in the research portion of the Department of Labor. And so with that funding, it was designed to do their requirements. That's what we're staffed for. Where possible, we would meet all the state requirements given that funding level. But without having additional funding and having the requirements to meet the funding, meet the federal requirements given their funding that they were paying us for, it did limit the magnitude of the types of projects we could do in other areas to meet other needs.
Mr. Chairman, I've been waiting with bated breath for a bill similar to this to come through to tack an amendment on, and I would like to have a comment. I want to, on the Finance Committee substitute, I'm going to propose an amendment that reads, appropriation for capital improvement projects that are less than $750,000 shall be exempted from the requirements of Alaska Statute 36.05.010. And I might, if I may, read that chapter or that section. It says a contractor or subcontractor who performs work on public construction to state is defined so-and-so shall pay not less than the current prevailing rates of wages for work of a similar nature in the region which work is done. The current prevailing wages, etc., is contained in the latest determination of prevailing rate of wages issued by the Department of Labor before the end of the pay period. To elaborate a little further, if I may, Mr. Chairman, what my problem is this. I've had capital projects in my district that's cost us many thousands more and had less people employed because of the fact that you take a contractor that maybe he's got 10 people there, he could pay $10 an hour, but the prevailing, so-called prevailing wage is going to be $15 an hour. So that's going to cut his workforce that he could employ in a local area in half. Consequently, that contractor is going to be very careful that he's going to bring more people in from outside the area to do the job rather than using local hire. And I've got several projects in my district now that I'm having to come back and beg the legislature to have me give me more money to finish projects out because of that simple fact. Now, I could have employed, for example, on one job, I could have employed twice the number of people, or a third more at least, on a project. Everybody had been happy as hell. They'd been working. At least they'd have had some money, and they wouldn't have been on unemployment. Now, I'd like to know what the thoughts are of the Labor Department on it, and I think you know where I'm coming from, because I've got two projects in Delta the same second way. I lost roads, I lost construction time. I got one project that's not completed because of the fact that we have a contractor who bid low, got the contract, almost completed the project, and then we're all tangled up with CRA and Labor Department because they say, hey, you got to pay it. Now I got to go back and beg the legislature now, Mr. Chairman, to give me more money for nothing. And yet I had more people employed on that project than I would have otherwise, and they were all local hires. And I'd just like to know what Labor has to say about it. I know I'm putting my foot in my mouth with the unions and things like that, but I'm trying to figure out how to put people to work out there in some of those small communities.
This is the point that would be better addressed by Dale Chica. The wage and hour particular section does not compute the prevailing wage or monitor a research section. It's similar to the concerns that have been brought up on the Davis-Bacon Act nationwide lately. And there was a good article in the Wall Street Journal about 2 days ago bringing out many of the same points that you have. But I'm really not the person to address those comments since I I don't work with the prevailing wage data.
Well, my point, Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, is this. A lot of projects that we've got now, we could get a lot more for a buck. Because we got people out there that just want a job, period. And they can't get a job because of the so-called prevailing wages. And if I was a contractor in some of these areas, I'd say to hell with the local people. Because I'm going to have people that I know how they can do the job. I'm not going to take a chance on a character out there that I don't know whether he can drive a nail or not. So I'm going to bring my own men in, and I'm going to justify it by saying that the skilled labor is not available in the community. And we had a contract in Fort Yukon. We got a lot more out of our buck. We got about 3 times the amount of building because we ended up, the contract was so that they could do it with local hire. And hey, man, we got about a third more building to Daniel Hack, more building out of what we had, the money available. But we got a problem. I don't know where the rest of you got that problem. Now, the urban areas, it's a different story, but I'm talking about in some of your rural areas, where there's some of your small projects, 100,000, 200,000, half a million projects are concerned. At least we got more people to work. They may not be making $15 an hour, but they are making 10, and that's better than none at all. And it's local people working in most cases like this. End of this statement. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to propose an amendment to the Finance Committee amendment, substitute.
Mr. Chairman, the repeal and modification of the state, Little David Staken Act, really doesn't apply to this bill. I understand
Representative Moss's problems, but I don't think it has anything to do with the bill before us. I did want to point out a thing on the reason I think we do require state funds. If you look at last year's budget for Department of Labor, the unemployment and employment sections, the total budget is $19,500,000. State funding is $200,000 of that. If you look at labor market information, the budget $600,000, state funding of that is $100,000. If you look at the research section, $550,000, state funding is $75,000. If you look at administration, total budget $2.3 million, state funding $350,000. So, you know, in the unemployment and employment area, we're funding less, almost exactly 1% of unemployment and employment offices, and we're funding roughly 1/7 of labor market information and research. And I think that's a reason that there hasn't been much labor market information or research that's directly towards the needs of the legislature for labor market information. It's a similar problem to what we've had with a university, which has been so highly federally funded in research that they've been doing research essential to federal needs, not state needs. And I think if we want information that's helpful to us, we're going to have to pay for it. And I think that this bill provides a vehicle to get that information.
Mr. Chairman, I might respond by saying I do think this is the appropriate. I'm speaking to the Finance Committee substitute. The first section, section one there, it says a bill requiring the appropriation of state money for capital so-and-so, and it shall tell you the number of jobs which would be created, including construction jobs, non-construction, etc., and other, and the type and the salaries. I think it would be most appropriate in this bill if that was put in, because you would need it in there if you were going to do the things that I'm requesting to be done. You'd need those figures, because it would be less costly to do a contract if we applied this type thing to certain categories of construction monies.
Well, your amount is as simple as just repealing Davis-Bacon for the last time.
Negative. It's not repealing the Davis-Bacon Act in the sense that it's only putting a special factor in it that we're talking about. It doesn't do anything over $750,000. It only applies to those smaller jobs underneath. And these small jobs are the ones that I'm talking about. We're doing most of our jobs out there are little jobs like that. A little community center or a fire hall or maybe even a school construction work, that an addition or classrooms or what have you. I wanted to put a million in, but I thought maybe that it would become too offensive then. But $750,000, I thought, would be a fairly reasonable figure to be considered, for the simple fact that that's where the majority
of our small contracts are. We got little street projects and things like that. But the major portion of the money, of course, would be in the big projects. And the big numbers are really in some of your more urban areas, and I wouldn't want to touch it. So in a sense, it just suspends the Bacon Act, Davis-Bacon Act, for any amount under $750,000. Now, whether it's legal or not, I don't know. But I think it'll put more people to work, and that's my concern, is putting more people to work. And like I said before, the pitch I'm making is that if I was a contractor out there and I had a contract and I had to get it done in a certain length of time, I'm not going to take a chance on some of the unknown factors of the people's ability to do a particular job in the community. I don't know whether he can drive nails or not, but I would be more willing to take a chance maybe on a one and a half bodies or two bodies. At least between the two of them, I could get it done, and I'd be employing more people. I want to point out, too, that it'll take a lot of people off of the unemployment compensation, too.
Well, have you got a municipality that we can appropriate the money directly to?
This is the thing. Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may respond, yes. I have one particular, well, I've got two or three municipalities that I'm thinking about that has a problem with contracts like this.
Well, in the first place, that contractor that gets that job, he has to hire his people out of the union hall. You know, I don't care where you are, you're going to have to do that. And they'll pick up local labor if they can't get anybody off. I guess it's the key list, isn't that the last end of the line?
Oh, I think
But they can hire local people, but they're not going
to
come. What?
They don't have to be union, they just have to take the damn wage, isn't that it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, we've got all kinds of things you'd have to research change over if you're going to get away from that problem. I don't care, and I know contractors moved into our area, and they're hiring all of them, you know, well, there's few men, usually the companies have a few men, and they all belong to union, and they know their particular skills there. And all, and it gets down to the common labor end. If they can't get them out of the union hall where the headquarters are, they will pick up local labor. And they'll have to pay them the prevailing wage. And that's all there's to it.
I think we might have a problem with single subject rule on this, but just to be sure, why don't we take a vote on the amendment? And if it passes, we'll get a legal from this whether or not a violation of the subject rule. If it doesn't, an amendment passes, then we'll go ahead and put it in.
What's the amendment?
The amendment would be in 508. Essentially, the effect amendment would be to suspend the requirement of the Davis-Bacon Act for any construction jobs under $750,000.
$750,000.
Could we see that? Is that in writing?
Let me read it off to you. The way I wrote it, I wrote a new section 3, appropriations of a capital improvement project that are less than $750,000 shall be exempted from the requirements of the last statute 36.05.010, which is the wagering on public construction. I'm just putting them on.
Chairman, we have a provision in state law, but I think that in the Davis-Bacon Act, it's a provision of federal law, so that, first of all, that provision, I don't think it applied to any project in which you have federal funds involved. I might be wrong on that. So.
I think that it's a situation worth discussing. I'm not sure that, again, I'm going to vote against it myself, just because I think it does kind of stretch the single subject restrictions, but I think it's not even worth pursuing. I'm not sure that I've been long
time to myself. Mr. Chairman, I might point out, as I said, in section 1 there, I think you've opened the door for me to propose this amendment. And the fact that you're going to study these things, number of jobs created, we're going to have more jobs if we can do it the way I'm talking about. And you're going to have a difference in the total cost of the labor there too, and I think you've opened the door. Even though this may not I think it's germane to this this matter here, because it is part and parcel. If you do that, then you've got to have those facts in this study you're asking for.
Right. All it says is if the the governor introduces a bill for a capital improvement project, he has to say how many jobs he's going to create in the class and so forth. President Rogers?
Yeah, I am concerned about single subject, and also, you know, the exemption from Little Davis Bacon is a major policy change that I think ought to be reviewed by the Labor and Commerce Committee. This one, the bill only relates to information to the legislature and not to doesn't have any effect on construction projects. This bill affects Title 24 and a small section of Title 37 to add a change in Title 34, was it, or whatever. Anyway, I think does violate single subject. I think it also
Title 37 is changing it too.
Tantamount to killing the bill, but and so I intend to vote against this. I think that the issue ought to be considered separately on its own merits.
Well, I think it has some merit. I mean, I'm not sure what the like Ernie was saying. It sounds like there's a lot of things that you might want to think about that would be happen as a result of a change like this, but I see what the point you're getting at. It's pretty obvious what's happening. A lot of people in your local communities aren't able to go to work as a result of the restrictions to their state. They don't get hired. So I don't blame you for being concerned about it.
Well, you could even amend the amendment even further by specifying general fund money.
I think that was your intention anyway.
Yes. I didn't spell it out in the language there, but that was my intent. I'm not talking about any federal funds, because I'm aware that we might have a problem with the federal law if it pertained to any money that came from the federal government. It would be strictly money and funds that would be from the general fund, which has no federal money involved in it.
Would you like to take a vote?
I might as well, because if I can't get it one way, I'll get it another. Maybe I should lobby some more. I don't want to lobby to death. I'd like to just pass some more bills out this morning.
Those in favor of it, remember.
I am.
Any other questions for me to follow up?
In fact, I deserve to put it out there. Earlier, you heard my statement, I referred my questions to Representative Rogers. And I believe that the service is still being provided out in rural areas where the locations of job information is placed in the
Department of Labor Manpower, where they're placing the number of construction workers, carpenters, and so forth. And they've also given on a month-to-month reports as far as the employment conditions, the number of people employed, head of households, and that sort of information is still coming in. Am I correct?
Okay. The information, excuse me, let me see if we produce several pieces of information. This is a publication that comes out monthly on many of the areas. The local job service offices will have on their records who is available work at that particular point in time, and also what job orders are being placed through them at that particular point in time. The information requirements here are greater than the job orders that are placed through the employment service, and it's also looking out into the future. So that you'll be able to assess the impact that legislation you'd pass would have, given the framework of the entire demand for an occupation, not just what job orders happen to be in the job service offices at that particular point in time. For instance, if you're proposing a construction project, it will probably be at least a couple of years before it will come to fruition, and the people who are on the employment service rolls or the job orders that are in the job bank
at that time won't really be the same conditions that will be existing at the time that the impact of the legislation comes to fruition. This is looking farther out in the future so that you can have a better idea of what the conditions would be given the trends in the economy, the projects that have already been approved that are coming online, that type of thing.
Okay. Next question is the economic activity in the rural areas. You can pretty much predict the unemployment versus the employment rate because it's seasonal work, right?
Seasonality is a definite factor. There's, I'm trying to get too technical. You have several trends that are going on at the same time. If you are having some construction projects, for instance, they will do it when the ground is available, is at the right moisture and such to be able to work on them, but they would still have to have the resources and the economic circumstances to build it, even if the climatic factors would permit it. So there's the impact of the season, there's also the impact of the whatever is driving the economy in that area that makes the level. We had seasons of similar nature climatically, 1976, 80, but had entirely different employment levels in the industries, areas, and regions.
During that time, because of made projects like the pipeline, and the month after the pipeline, we had many people who were employed.
Does the Department of Labor have today? Do you know? 1,300?
I didn't bring that type of information with me. I'm dealing with a small research section of about 30 people.
I would say between 600 and 700.
600 and 700, that's fine. That if the fiscal note that's in our packet, one dated 5/8 has 6.5 full times, and the other one dated 5/1/81 has 8 full-time employees. Don't you think that perhaps if the commissioner directed you to perform this job within the number of 600 to 700 employees, that perhaps that Department of Labor can fulfill this commitment in this bill?
What we're looking at, sir, would be redirecting people from other units of the Department of Labor. People who are making sure that people get their unemployment checks, people who are placing individuals, people who are making the various portions per wage an hour, fresh vessels, etc. And the information is a compartment that is separately funded. They've got their mandates to accomplish certain jobs with the funding they have. We're looking at...
If I might respond once again, there aren't more than half a dozen in this area that are state funded. All the rest are federally funded, and we can't require federal funds to be used to meet our needs. The federal funds always have strings attached, and the federal government requires certain information be produced with those federal funds. We can't order the commissioner to change what they're doing with the federal funds. We can order him what to do with state funds. And as I said, there's only in last year's budget, between labor market information and research, the two major sections here, there's only $179,000 worth of state funding. And so you know, Department of Labor is almost completely a federally funded agency. Something like 90% of their total budget is federal funds, and it's only in a couple of areas that it has any state funds at all. And unfortunately, you know, the golden rule, he who has the gold rules, the federal government rules what that agency does, not us. And the only way we're going to turn it around is for us to put some money in it, if that's what we want to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I believe they're ready to go.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, one more, I'd like to ask Mr. Augustine one more time on this one, price of standpoint, that's on 508.
Okay.
And section one, the language says the capital improvement project or state loan program is presented by the governor. There's a reduction on there, it's 34-30. My question was, the reason was why just the governor, not the legislature? And my thought was that I would think that the governor, if he looked at a bill like this, if it did reach his desk and required the administration to do certain things on the bill to save, and didn't require the same thing for
the legislature, that it would be only more safe for that bill. And give it maybe a chance of life if we also, if we just eliminated the word by the governor and on 13 under AS 243060B on line 14, maybe it might conserve a chance of final approval. I don't know, I'm not going one way or the other, but I think it's a thought worth considering. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think that I'd be amenable to the deletion of by the governor on line 13, though probably not on line 26, because there you're talking about where you've got several different appropriations under a million, and a legislator might introduce a few that didn't, isn't until halfway through the session that it totals over a million. And I'd have no objection to deleting on page 1, line 13, the words by the governor, and on line 14, under AS 2430060B. The only problem I can see is that sometimes when we introduce a bill for a construction project in our districts, we don't know how quickly DOT is going to actually bring them on. So it's hard to estimate it by quarter. And one of the sort of hidden things in this is that knowing by over a period of time when the jobs are going to be, it may help them to get the Department of Transportation to tell them when they're going to do jobs that we appropriate money for. That's not right out in the open in this bill, but it could be effective.
I wouldn't necessarily, I'm not sponsoring that as an amendment, but it just seems to me that it's something that should be considered. As a matter of fact, I approve of the whole idea of the bill. It should apply to everybody, and I'm sure it would cause some problems for legislators, but it's my honest opinion, and I said this before, that the way we're appropriating at this point in time, the way we're appropriating money for capital projects is absolutely insane. We have no idea for how many people are going to hire. We don't have any idea how many of those jobs are going to require the importation of contractors, equipment, and the labor to do the job. And we just have no kind of no knowledge of any kind of what we're actually doing. So I think there might be some better than the whole idea, but if it just applies to the governor, he doesn't have any projects left in his capital budget anyway, it doesn't really mean
I'd certainly accept that as a friendly amendment if Mr. Chairman wished to move it.
Right, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that is sort of relevant to this the discussion there is where the point was made is that we don't always know when a project is going to go out to bid or when the work is going to start on a project authorized and funded by the legislature. Sometimes we do, but usually the cases in which we don't know that is when, for instance, perhaps in the budget this year there might be a project for $5 million funded that's never been on the drawing boards. So the first thing happens if the project is funded is after the bill signed and a work order number or something is assigned to the project, they start planning the project out. And that does take some time. When they get done with that, DOT or whoever the responsible agency is, say DOT, when they get done with that, then they have a calculated what the scope of the project's going to have to be in order to fit within the appropriation, or what the appropriation is going to have to be to cover the scope of the project, and the latter is more likely. So I wonder if we shouldn't consider putting something in this legislation that would provide on projects, say, over $1 million, that the way the funding cycle would work is that the initial appropriation would be for the planning and preliminary design on the project. We do that for some projects now, at least we have it in law for some projects now. An example would be the projects that the Power Authority has to take responsibility for. They have feasibility studies and they have reconnaissance studies and so forth. But we don't do that for other complex capital projects necessarily. Some of those are done by, say, the Department of Transportation as part of their program, but a lot of projects are funded that haven't been looked at except in the discussion stage before that. And I'd like to have comments from the committee about that possibility. Now, it runs into the same problem as the bill itself does, and how do you get the legislature to adhere to it? You put it in the law and they fund a project that says this, notwithstanding the provisions of 2430032, because nobody can come up maybe with an estimate of the jobs on the project, but the project's funded. So I guess you could do the same thing on any planning or engineering requirements on a project. But the failure to do those things, leads to problems. I could set an example from my district where I asked the DOT for an estimate on what I thought was a minor job of putting some riprap on a breakwater. They estimated $88,000, I think, in 79. On the session adjourned, they said their estimate was wrong. It needed to be $300,000. So the next year, the additional money was appropriated. And the estimate on the project now is $900,000. I suppose if you put $900,000 up, it'll be up again. But maybe not. But that, I think everybody's faced with kinds of problems. And if we put projects on a cycle, at least the larger ones, where the first phase of funding was for the planning and preliminary design, and then when you appropriate the money for the project construction, it would be with some certainty that the project probably would go to bid at least on the following construction season. Right now, it's certainly not the case on any major project. I think it's reasonable to require that some level of preliminary analysis on a project to be done before it's funded for construction, and that information be a good minimum standard, and unless that's there, I don't want to dumb up
to Gardner and Mr. Rogers' bill. But I think that we ought to have some provision in the law, at least as a guideline. I think the problem is you put it in there, how to get the legislature to follow it. But I think it is resulting in, for instance, money being appropriated to projects at incorrect times. And a lot of money are appropriated to projects that, you know, people think for some reason it's going to create jobs. Why can't they create jobs for 3 or 4 years? Because in some cases, because it's going to take that long to sort the whole thing out. If that were done first, then when you appropriated the money, you'd know, say, this year, you'd know, say, in a construction season of 82, that project was going to go to bid. You could, with some reliability, predict the impact of employment from the project. I don't have a specific amendment to offer right now. I don't want to dumb up the bill, but I think that somehow that's got to be dealt with. And if we could get things to the point where any major project could, some preliminary planning and design was done before the project was authorized and funded for construction, then some of these problems that we've had in the past would be there.
I think that could be done as a policy decision by either House or by the governor. Just no project would go unless that was followed. In fact, the Fairbanks delegation essentially has decided on that and is not funding any projects for which, at least we're not requesting funding in the capital budget for any projects which aren't ready to go. If they're not ready to go, we're only funding planning, engineering, and design funds. And I think that in talking with other legislators, a number of people are doing the same thing. That maybe some projects are going to lose out if the legislature changes and the money's not funded. But I think that means that's one of the reasons that when we went back to try to steal money from last year's House Bill 60, it was time to steal.
You know, I've talked about this for years, but we ought to have just what you were talking about, but I think it has to be a separate bill. It could be a guideline. Probably all of it is administrative and legislative, but, you know, the major projects, you got to have plan designing and engineering. And today, you don't just go out and build a project on bare fact. You got to go through the EPA and all the rest of these agencies. I mean, you get into these. But getting back to what Brian is trying to do here, you're trying to project jobs in certain areas. And how that is a database. Well, I don't think we have to create another paper mill and spend all this money on it to do that. We know just about where the big labor jobs is. But what you're really trying to do is to get the local control, aren't you? Okay, the way you do that, and I've done it in my villages many times, just appropriate an amount of money to the village and let them do the job. Then they have control of local hire and everything else. The gas project out here at Angoon is the latest one. There is this market, street work, street maintenance, and here it's all done by local labor, riders, corporations, and where we make it. And that's the way to get control of it. If you get into these big jobs where you got to hire get these contractors, they're just wired into the AGC contract. They've got no way out of it. They've got to hire their people out of the union hall. And if there are some local people, because they can't get them out of the union hall, they'll pick up local labor. If there's a person in that community that carries a card for whatever craft it is, usually in a local job, he gets custom door over a guy in the union hall. I mean, that's the way it works.
You're talking about those plumbing workers you're talking about. When you come outside, I tell you right now, you can't hire enough people in Alaska running the cameras. You don't have it. You have a local labor force, and beyond that, they have to come from someplace else.
Okay, Mary Hawk Lowe, still, real House Resources Committee. Here. I've gotten a plan to be here, but since he's not here. The bill sets out agricultural goals of the state, as you see on the first page. It was felt that after the House Resources Committee completed hearings on agriculture, that more comprehensive long-range planning was needed, and that the state needed to set down the direction in which agriculture should proceed, and so therefore we set out the goals, and that a requirement that a 10-year plan be drawn up by the Agriculture Action Council containing a number of things, the 12 items. And that the Agriculture Action Council was given a year and a half, basically, to complete the agriculture planning.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes, can I ask why the committee chose the Action Council rather than the Division of Agriculture to do the plan?
The Division of Agriculture was felt that it needed to be a more comprehensive plan, that fish and game needed to be brought in, that commerce and economic development, that community and regional affairs, the regional development plan should be brought in, the integration too of, say, DOT's plans, say, for coal transportation systems, that those plans be compatible and that agriculture development coincide so that it be broader input.
Well, I guess that must assume the passage of the changes to the Action Council, because without those changes, the current Action Council is primarily designed for agribusiness.
There's a in the Resource Committee passed out at the same time they passed this bill out, House Bill 535, which is in rules. It doesn't have a fiscal note. And that is the recomposition of the Agriculture Action Council. Basically what it does right now, the council is composed of 5 members appointed by the governor, and there's no stipulation as to criteria for selection. The bill, House Bill 535, stipulates that the council chairman shall be elected from council members rather than appointed by the governor, and that it be expanded to 7 members. The members are specified: Commissioner of Department of Natural Resources, Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development, a representative of the governor's office, then one non-specified resident of the state, one resident engaged in dairy or ranching, one resident engaged in rural agriculture or small-scale agriculture projects or ventures, and one person engaged in farming, generalized farming in the state, so that it would be a more representative, or ensure that it would be a more representative body.
Mr. Chairman, with the passage of that change, I have no objection to the Action Council.
Mr.
On your fiscal note, you got $812,000. You got a budget breakdown on how this would be spent on the 12 listed items?
We don't have a breakdown right now.
Okay, my question would be to you, how did you come up with a figure of $800,000? Could you use $200,000 maybe?
Basically, the Agriculture Action Council and Commerce and Economic Development came up with the $800,000 figure. That is for FY82, and that would be the first year of the study, or in coming up with a plan. The intention, as I understand it, at this point in time of the council, is to contract for much of that to be done. So it would be contracted out with someone to put together the economic feasibility work, for example. There's no set plan.
Without a budget plan or the sort of amount how this money's going to be expended, then I would object to your fiscal vote. Thank you. Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, I have the same concern about the fiscal note. I think a good plan is going to cost some money, but compared with other work, and given the fact that the Red Action Council has a project director, a researcher, and a clerical person, I'm sure they would want to contract some of this. I think any number we pick is a ballpark. In reading the resolution, and I support very strongly development of a 10-year plan, my my figure based on previous contractual work is almost, I would have come up with almost exactly half that. That approximately 400,000 would be adequate, 400 to 500.
If I may answer, there's two things. One, it is felt that the Agriculture Action Council has the responsibility by statute to administer the Delta project and to come up with new projects. They have to carry on those tasks. Plus, we are giving them an additional duty of coming up with this comprehensive long-range plan with a great deal of work necessary to provide the 12 items. So that it was felt they would have to add either staff or contract out for this to be done, that the existing staff cannot carry their existing load plus this additional work. And the other thing was we received comments from the University of Alaska, which set a price tag at for just simply a computer simulation model at $580,000, I believe. It was looked at that Nenatochacket received last year $500,000 alone, just simply looking at Nenatochacket development, one single project, and that several consultants had been questioned on this as to what they felt would be a reasonable cost. They were projecting $1 million. So this is what Commerce and Economic Development and the Ag Council came up with, but we were comparing it to also those other.
Mr. Moss, Mr. Chairman, thank you. In resources, did they take into consideration to direct the Ag Council to first make a study or a check in to see about all the development programs and all of the studies that's been done so far? I'll use an illustration. The Featherstone study that has just been brought out as a result of some of the work on the Tokchakit deal. We have planning studies that we did on the Delta South Shore. Land use planning deal, that's a study that has to be considered in new areas and so forth, one like that. And working on this 800,000, was any consideration taken that we could utilize a lot of the previous studies already and maybe cut this cost down? That Tokchakit study, for example, there's a number of studies went in there, there's a number of studies went in at Delta. The studies that's gone into transportation and so forth, was any consideration taken to direct the Ag Council to first try to obtain or gather together all those reports so that we wouldn't be trying to contract out something that had already been done a half a dozen times?
The Ag Council already has the responsibility to gather and coordinate the information on agricultural development in the state, and they've contracted, not Featherstone, I don't believe, but many of those studies. So there is no directive in this resolution, and there's been no directive to the Ag Council to ensure that all those are brought in. I would guess that they would be brought in simply because they are, by statute, they have the responsibility to coordinate that information, and that all those pieces would have to be drawn in. I don't know how they took it into account in coming up with this fiscal note, however.
My concern, Mr. Chairman, was that we've got a lot of work that we've done in the past, and part of the reason for having something like this set up is to bring two or three areas together. This is part of the problem that we've had in the agricultural development. We've got every Tom, Dick, and Harry making some kind of study out somewhere, and Tom don't know what Dick's doing, and Harry don't know what either one of the other two is doing. And the point is, we've got a lot of good data that's been brought together. And I'm just wondering if maybe we shouldn't really direct that they do the research work to find out how much data we do have.
Economic Development and Ag Council were here to defend the 800,000. However, when such a plan is let out to contract, does one stipulate a breakdown before you let something like this out to contract, or after you set the price on?
Mr. Chairman, it's my feeling that the bids on this, whether it's broken down into components or it's one single component, but are likely to total up to whatever the amount of money we provide is.
And providing them a little bit leaner on the money would mean they'd have to try to make use of other people's work to a larger extent than if you give them enough money to redo the work.
Mr. Chairman, I concur with what Representative Rogers said. It seems like if you, I just read one on my desk now that's just been completed. It was $230,000 budgeted last year for a particular study, and I've been watching it with interest as the progress near completion, and the completed bill came in, and that was $226,000 such. So I think that that statement is correct. So normally when you need a service and you put the service out the bid, then you accept the bids and you take the best, lowest bid. But the concern is not the money as much as still. We just see this figure and we don't see anything on it. We don't say whether it's going to be one study or two studies. I just think it's not ready to go out until we have a better explanation of how that $800,000 is just a shot in the dark.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Carney.
Yeah. Well, you know, it appears to me that you either get what you pay for. And so when you have a lump sum figure to work with from up front, then you simply write into your proposal a number of things you think that dollar value will buy. And so I think that there is a possibility of adjusting the scope of the study to match the money we provide. But I agree with Roger that, you know, if it has $500,000, then it's worth them to be more careful about what they get into. I think we could pass down the basis of $500,000.
Mr. Chairman, I might throw something in.
The $800,000 is, I think, back here. I think we had a $300,000 appropriation that we cut out of the marketing study on grain that we cut out of Senate Bill 162. This might, $300,000 would make that $800,000 over the $500,000 we're talking about. This might be the place to get our $300,000 back.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that page 1, line 26, be deleted and replaced with the words, phase out state subsidies for agriculture which exceed those for other renewable resource industries.
Mr. Rogers, let's hold that just a second. Is there anyone else here to testify on this? If not. All right. Did you hear the motion, the amendment? Do you understand?
I'd ask a little better explanation. Phase out state.
Delete financing and then continue. Subsidies for agriculture, and insert, which exceed those for other renewable resource industries.
Now, does that mean which exceed any single other renewable resource industry, or exceed a total of all other renewable resource industries?
Whichever you prefer.
Well, it's your amendment, not mine.
Mr. Chairman, I think the whole section is a bad section. I was just trying to preserve the only part that had any worth. Maybe I'll withdraw my amendment and allow Representative Moss to move his.
Mr. Moss? Mr. Chairman, I would make motion that we delete line 26, phase out state financing and substitute for agriculture.
Question, that would be all of item 5?
Right. All of item 5.
You heard the motion. Is there objection?
Object.
Mr. Malone.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just object to the motion on general principle. If an industry reaches a point where it's a healthy industry and doesn't need these subsidies anymore, then I don't know any reason to provide them. And I think that the goal here would be to develop an industry that would be self-supporting. So I don't think it's inconsistent with the whole purpose of state agriculture development to leave that language in there. It doesn't say we're going to phase them out today or tomorrow or next year, but that it, I think it's consistent with the idea that we would provide, that we're trying to accomplish a self-supporting industry. Now, if the intent is to have an industry that's never self-supporting, then I suppose we should take out Section 5 there, but I don't really think that's anybody's intent.
Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Chairman, that was the reason that I offered my amendment that seemed to draw some problems. You know, my concern here is, you know, this agricultural development has never really gotten very much state support compared with fisheries development over the years, and fisheries is a much bigger industry. And my problem is that the Resources Committees in the past, and the first time really that the chairman of the Resources Committee has taken a strong interest in something other than fisheries. And I'm just worried that in the future people will just point to this and say, 2 years from now, say, good reason to eliminate any funding for agriculture, when in fact we've been subsidizing the fisheries industry for the last 20 years.
Particularly in the last few with development of hatcheries. If we had developed a policy statement 20 years ago that says phase out subsidies for fisheries, then those people from non-fisheries areas could come in every year saying, do away with the Fred Division.
I'm not arguing for that, but I'm arguing that that this goal of phasing out state subsidies for agriculture, period, could be used as a reason for eliminating any state spending for an action council, any state spending for a division of agriculture, or at some point for a department of agriculture, and so on. The word subsidy is a difficult word to define, and I don't see any reason why we should say that this particular renewable resource industry, we want to phase out subsidies, and not say we want to phase them out for other renewable resource industries. I think that to take an industry in its infancy and say we want to phase out subsidies when a good, healthy industry is also getting state subsidies, I think it's pretty clear discrimination.
Mr. Moss, Mr. Carney, Mr. Wall. Mr. Chairman, I might point out something here. The thing that would scare me a little bit on this is if we phase out a subsidy on agriculture, then that means that the 6% interest money that we got in some of these 30- and 40-year loans, what are we going to do, go back and run the interest up to the prevailing rate?
That's basically what will happen. We'll have some lawyer picking the pepper out of the fly specks, and that's what he's going to say. That's a subsidy. And consequently, they'll try to run the interest rates up, and the guy's going to have to pay more interest on his loans. And the same thing applies to a lot of other subsidies that we got in the state. We got subsidies on housing loans. We got a subsidy on business loans and everything else. And that is an outright subsidy itself. We just passed some deals the other day where we're subsidizing bond interest money is about 2% that we're subsidizing, an outright subsidy. So the word subsidy shakes the living daylights out of me. And because you are subsidizing any kind of business in the state right now that you're giving them a break on loan monies. And that's why I would say that we delete that, because I don't want some smart guy picking the pepper out of the fly stack coming here one day and say, hey, cut it out.
I'm a folk, sir.
Does my name sound better now?
Yeah, sounds better now.
Mr. Moss, I was just going to comment that this is only a resolution, and all it does is respectfully request the governor. And I remember we voted on a bill yesterday that had a letter of intent that had to do with the bond bank that says nothing's going to happen, and somebody said, I forget it. So I'm not too concerned. Mr. Carson?
Well, I think in response to this and Malone's point, I think it's good that him does this.
Line is that there's an inference that agriculture is getting more than its share of subsidy. I don't like that. I don't like the indication that there's any consideration for doing away with the state being involved in making loans for agriculture, because
I would envision that continuing for a long period of time. But I think the whole thrust of this resolution is to do exactly what that line says, but how far down the road are we, and does it have to be studied? You know, the study itself, in essence, over a period of 25 years, we're trying to do away with the need for state loans and subsidies. Well, I think it can be taken out without, in any way, hampering the ability that we do to study state agriculture.
Mr. Malone, would you yield to Mr. Gardner? He got here late.
You can recognize me,
Mr. Chairman.
I was going to offer an amendment to the motion offered by Representative Moss, which would be to delete the present language in Section 5 and substitute the word develop a self-supporting agricultural industry in Alaska.
Good.
Mr. Gardner. Mr. Chairman, I have to make the observation. But this section is what the state's policy is. It doesn't tell them to study that particularly. If you look at the study provisions, that's not one contained. I think everybody realizes what people said. You're going to have to subsidize the agricultural industry right now. But in terms of what this is stating, what the state's policy is, and I think everybody agrees that at some point they want the agricultural industry and other industries in the state to stand on their own two feet. And I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that they believe they should subsidize the industry forever. And so this, you shouldn't confuse this section, which is a statement of state policy, with the study section. It doesn't recommend that anybody come back next year and phase out subsidies. That's not even in the study provision.
Mr.
ask for unanimous consent for Representative Malone's amendment to amendment.
We held the bill from transmitting it up here pending a fiscal note. We didn't want to come up here and ask for some money when it couldn't be detailed what it was. So we went round and round. Was it $100,000? Was it $2 million? Or what was it?
And finally, last week, I think some people may have talked with some people from the Winthrop Rockefeller Agricultural Foundation, which is a pretty impressive group of people who had done agricultural development work all over this country and in other countries in the world, similar to what we're talking about in Alaska. In fact, it's a much bigger project. So I met with them, and we went over this resolution and asked them for their advice on how much it would cost to do this, what kind of time frame, was this realistic, and everything. They said that it really was a two-year project, and they estimated that in other projects they've been doing, places where maybe it wasn't even as expensive as Alaska, that if we were going to do this right, it would be probably cost about $1 million. So I asked Mr. Palmer to be sure and sit down with them and to try to detail out something, because I said you can't just ask for lump sum. Finance committee and others are going to want to know how you're going to use the money. When I questioned them, I said, why did you pick $1 million? They said, look here, you guys, the state of Alaska spent $500,000 on one project alone last year in Nenana. Just one project. The plan for that project alone, we spent $500,000 in 1 year. And now you're talking about trying to use less money than that to do the total plan for the state. And they, in fact, they had some sort of adverse comments about the quality of work that was done for that $500,000. They didn't think we really necessarily got our money's worth out of that $500,000. We've spent similar amounts of money or more in the planning for the Delta project in Point McKinley. There's a lot of money went in to lay those projects out. And I don't know in detail what it is, but I was convinced by them that some area of money like this was necessary. And, you know, I'm not on the finance committee and don't pretend to know how to write budgets or, you know, how much you go to personal services, how much you go to contractual. I'd hope that somebody could figure that out, but evidently they haven't been able to. And this was the best we were able to get out of the administration after waiting several weeks.
Yeah, I was concerned that the best we could get was a lump sum that they ballpark $800,000. And, you know, I can ballpark as well as they can.
You know, when you're looking at tow traffic, for example, when you're looking at details of a project, you're getting a lot more detail than we really want them to get into on an overall 10-year plan. And that does take some... The difference between detailed work and a master plan, you know, you're not getting into that kind of detailed work. And in fact, you know, my opinion is for the amount of detailed work that went into tow tax, when they started, I mean, I've seen some of the money they spent there went into designing the bridges. And we're not going to be designing bridges with this money. That's in relation to the chairman of the resource committee, I'm convinced that maybe we do need an amendment on this thing. Which would amend it upward, amendment up to 1.1. That would put another 300,000 on there. I agree with it. Maybe we do need that 300,000, but we also need another 300,000 to finish up this green marketing study.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask that question. Has Alaska Ag Council, since it's stated in the bill, that there is to coordinate the preparation of this 2-year plan
would have any other recommendation, if any target could have given, as to the amount. Because the fact that it's coming out with $300,000 just bothers me. It would seem now if the Ag Council is going to coordinate the preparation of this senior plan. Someone else brought up the fact that there are certain studies and certain information that's already available. I would hope that they would know about that available. And then, if there's a portion, our portion lacking, and that's what we want to go by, maybe some monitor justification of the $300,000 could be presented. But I would hope to try to defend us without having more than just a figure. And that's why my problem.
Mr. Cotting and Mr. Malone, do you want to
The bill didn't come here because it didn't have any financial implications, but the Controller General should expand the intentions of membership on the Ag Council for one thing to put the commissioner in 3NR.